At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It was a choice between the devil and the deep blue sea. Stand by and watch as millions of gallons of oil soiled the Gulf coastline, or set the sea on fire and hope that it burns itself out. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday. It is the 28th day of April. Today, in what can only be described as an act of environmental desperation, the U.S. Coast Guard began setting fire to parts of a giant oil slick that continues to spread just off the Louisiana coast. The so-called controlled burn and the acrid black smoke it will send into the atmosphere will, in the best-case scenario, keep the oil from drifting onto coastal estuaries and wetlands. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports the cleanup crews have no easy choices.
So far, the well's owner, British Petroleum, is paying for the cleanup. But the Coast Guard's Mary Landry, who's coordinating the burn, says in the end, others will also bear the costs.
We've got all the tools, all the resources for the appropriate oversight from federal, state, And I would tell you, the industry has brought all the resources to bear.
The American Petroleum Institute's Allison Nyholm says burning the oil is preferable to letting it reach land.
You're able to take care of 90 to 98% of the oil. And then what is left is a waxy sheen that can be skimmed off the top.
And Nyholm says burning should work well in this case.
This oil is light sweet crude. It's excellent for this type of burning. So it's of the perfect type to deal with it in a very rapid, quick manner.
But burning will cause air pollution, carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide, and other toxic particles.
This is a sad state of affairs because it's a real lose-lose proposition.
Jackie Savitz is a senior scientist with the conservation group Oceana. She says burning is better than letting the oil spread to fisheries and marine habitats. Already stressed populations of bluefin tuna, grouper, and snapper are spawning now. The oil spill threatens to eat away at the $200 million a year Gulf fishing industry.
We're losing oil, you know, which is a shame because oil is a very valuable resource. There's a huge cost associated with that that, you know, really we all pay because this is a common resource for all Americans.
Until the well can be capped, it continues to spew 42,000 gallons of oil a day into the Gulf. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Today, the Federal Reserve decided to keep short-term interest rates right where they are at record levels. And it indicated they'll stay that way for, quote, an extended period. That helped send stocks up, and so did more strong profit reports from corporate America. Dow Chemical says its net income surged almost 2,300%. The reason? Just one word: plastics. Jill Barshay reports.
The world's newest and greatest superhero, Plastic Man. He can spring. He can stretch. He can bounce.
If you want to see signs the economy is bouncing back, look no farther than plastic. George Van Horn is a manufacturing analyst at IBIS World Industry Research. He says Dow Chemical's earnings are like a broad economic indicator.
Because plastics find their way into every nook and cranny, really, of the economy.
Dow Chemical says it's been getting more orders for the kind of plastic that goes into cell phones and electronics, and for plastic wrap. Bill Wood is a plastics market economist at Mountaintop Economics and Research. He says plastic packaging always recovers first. That's because consumer patterns start to shift in the supermarket.
You could buy a head of lettuce, or you could buy prepackaged salad. You could buy a block of cheese, or you could buy pre-grated cheese. But as the economy recovers, consumers tend to purchase more of the pre-processed packaged stuff.
A surge in plastic wrap is also a sign that companies are restocking their warehouses. New pallets are covered with rolls of it. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
Hopefully, Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein and Senator Carl Levin got to sleep in this morning after yesterday's 11-hour marathon grilling of Goldman execs on Capitol Hill. As we reported yesterday, senators took turns asking whether the investment giant had an obligation to tell clients when they were selling them a shoddy product. Blankfein responded that Goldman's sophisticated investors knew what they were getting into.
People lost money in it, but the security itself delivered the specific exposure that the client wanted to have.
But if Goldman is so right, why would anyone want to bet against them? Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has that story from New York.
Let's start with the basic premise that in every trade, there's a winner and a loser.
If I think that this stock is going to go up and therefore I buy it, who is the idiot who is selling it to me?
Mayor Statman teaches behavioral finance at Santa Clara University.
So there is an idiot in every trade, and if you don't know who it is, it's you.
He says people who think Goldman is the idiot are either overconfident or they're just looking for some adventure with a firm that seems to have a track record similar to that of the annoying blackjack dealer in the movie Vegas Vacation.
19.
20.
Oh, he's good. He's good.
Hugh Johnson of Johnson Illington Advisors doesn't dispute Goldman's record, but he says sophisticated investors are attracted to Goldman because of how the trades there are crafted.
Goldman Sachs is real good at putting together synthetic securities that will appeal both to the buyer and the seller in a transaction.
So everyone thinks they're getting a fair shot, and the house doesn't always win.
Goldman isn't always right. Sometimes Goldman is wrong. But the institutional investors that enter into transactions, I have a very strong belief that they're right.
Johnson, by the way, doesn't count himself in that group. He says he doesn't trade with Goldman.
I'm not that sophisticated, I guess.
Or as Professor Statman might say, he's no idiot. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
As we mentioned, investors cheered the Fed's decision to maintain near-zero interest rates, offsetting big concerns about the financial situation in Europe. We'll have details when we do the numbers. There are good and bad updates today about the financial crisis in Europe. The good? Germany and the International Monetary Fund reaffirmed their commitment to bail out Greece. The bad? Spain became the third European country in 2 days to have its bond rating downgraded. Yesterday it happened to Greece and Portugal. With us now to discuss the European crisis and its wider implications is our European Bureau Chief Stephen Beard, who is in London. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Tess.
Why has this crisis taken what seems to be a sudden and fairly dramatic turn for the worse?
S&P's downgrade of Greek government debt to junk status has done it. It's the clearest signal yet that Greece could actually default, and bondholders then wouldn't get all of their money back, perhaps not much of their money. It means that a whole bunch of investment funds are now not allowed to buy Greek government bonds or to continue holding them. So the bonds have become toxic. And just to give you a taste of a flavour of this, Tess, the cost of borrowing for some Greek bonds hit almost 20% today. That's Banana Republic territory.
Right.
It means the market regards countries like Azerbaijan and Lebanon as less of a risk than Greece, which is a member of the Eurozone.
Amazing. Give us a little bit of perspective on the latest rescue package for Greece. What's involved there?
Well, we had the head of the IMF, the European Central Bank, and the German Chancellor Angela Merkel meeting in Berlin today to talk about this rescue package. The big stumbling block has been Germany, which has pledged a big chunk of the rescue package. It's offered Greece emergency loans of about $11 billion. But the German government has got to pass legislation to free up this cash. And there's a lot of hostility in Germany towards this. I mean, the German taxpayers feel Greeks have been profligate and that instead of knuckling down and accepting some austerity, all the Greeks seem to do is go out on the streets and protest. Nevertheless, the German government wants some stability back in European financial markets, and the loans could be approved within a week.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, just out of selfishness, you would think that they would need to help, because isn't there a danger of contagion throughout the Eurozone?
S&P yesterday downgraded Portuguese government debt, not quite a junk status, but a downgrade nevertheless. And today we heard the rating agency also downgraded Spanish government debt. And this is very worrying because Spain is a much bigger economy than Greece, three or four times the size. And it's pretty unlikely that the Germans and the rest of the Eurozone would have much of an appetite for bailing out an economy the size of Spain. So all this is undermining confidence in the euro and raising questions about its long-term future.
Well, that's not really all it's undermining. You know, the U.S. stock market has apparently caught a bit of the European cold. Why has the Greek crisis gone global at this point?
There is a deeper anxiety at work here. It's about government debt. Many governments have spent billions bailing out their banks and stimulating their economies. So this year, they'll be borrowing billions more than they usually do. The U.S. alone is going to be borrowing more than $1 trillion. And mm-hmm. the Greek crisis has crystallized a fear. What if investors don't want to buy all these bonds? How many governments will go bust? And what will that do to the world's still quite fragile economic recovery?
Marketplace's Stephen Beard joining us from London with some perspective on what's going on in Greece and the rest of the Eurozone. Thanks so much.
Okay, Tess.
The United States has been pressuring China to boost the value of its currency. That would help narrow the U.S. trade deficit with that country. Commentator David Frum recently returned from a State Department-sponsored tour of Chinese universities, and he found students were passionately concerned about the currency question.
In 2 weeks in China, you see many different amazing things. But visiting a range of Chinese university campuses, you hear the same one thing over and over again. They say, in the 1980s, you destroyed your strongest ally, Japan, by forcing Japan to increase the value of its currency. Now you want to destroy China the same way. There was no debunking that paranoid view. You could explain that China's radically undervalued currency has produced China's nightmare real estate bubble, pricing young people out of the market. You could go historical, point out that the upvaluation of the Japanese currency in the mid-1980s was followed by an increase in Japanese economic power, not a decline. No perceptible impact. Maybe what was important was the question behind the question. Here is China, huge, dynamic, and suddenly so rich that in a recent Gallup poll, 43% of Americans predicted that the 21st century would be dominated by China, as against only 38% who believed that the century would be led by the United States. Yet these students believe that their country's rise could be halted by a frown from the almighty United States. Is that a concern about American hostility, or an expression of a gnawing self-insecurity? In China, there is lots to be insecure about. environmental degradation, the widening gap between rich and poor, the ballooning real estate bubble, poisoned milk and skyscrapers that burst mysteriously into flames, and a control freak government flailing to suppress Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Perhaps it's less uncomfortable for the students to approach these topics obliquely by talking about something that edges up to the subjects they really have in mind. I therefore learned to answer the students' questions with another question, the question behind the question. To their question, why do you sell arms to Taiwan? The answer, why does Taiwan want to buy them? And to their question, what will you do about our misaligned currency that threatens to wreck our economy? With, what will you do about your misaligned currency that threatens to wreck your economy?
David Frum is founder of the website Frum Forum and a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. We welcome your questions and opinions. Go to marketplace.org. Coming up, a tip on how to master any skill.
If you don't approach it with a voracious appetite, if you don't clock up what Anders Ericsson, a very famous psychologist from Florida, calls deliberate practice, it's not going to get you anywhere.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Fed says same old on interest rates, and Wall Street likes what it hears. The Dow rose 53 points, about 0.5%, to settle at 11,045. The Nasdaq traded nearly flat, adding a fraction of a percent, to finish at 2,471. The S&P 500 tacked on 7 points, 0.2%, to call it a day at 1,191. Just a day after being skewered by Congress, Goldman Sachs continued to climb. Shares gained more than 2.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase was also up 2.5%. On the earnings front, defense contractor Northrop Grumman reported a 21% jump in first quarter profits. Shares muscled up more than 2%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.76%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at HBR.org. And by Vanguard. Vanguarding is an investment philosophy designed to help individuals reach their financial goals. Vanguard.com. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Thursday. At the White House, President Obama presents the 2010 National Teacher of the Year Award. Also in D.C., Indian spiritual leader Sri Sri Ravi Shankar visits, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton meets with the Polish foreign minister almost 3 weeks after that country's president died in a plane crash. I'm Julia Simon.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. More than 800 women serve on the boards of Fortune 500 companies here in the U.S. 1.5 women per board may not sound like much, but it is a giant leap compared to the numbers you'll find in Germany. In Europe's biggest economy, women are almost completely absent from the boardroom. One German company decided to do something about that. From Berlin, Kyle James has our report.
Deutsche Telekom says that by the end of 2015, one-third of all its upper and middle management positions are to be filled by women. Spokeswoman Anna Wender says this recognizes the way the labor market is developing. 60% of today's university graduates in Germany are female. It's also about social fairness. But Wender says there's another big motivation.
It is simply an economic necessity because studies show that
teams with a greater diversity simply act more profitable and achieve better results.
The policy will apply to the entire Deutsche Telekom group, including T-Mobile in the United States. The company says despite incentives it had in place, not enough women were moving up the corporate ladder, especially into top management. At meetings of professional business women, like this one in Berlin, the problems of gender discrimination are often discussed, and the picture sometimes seems bleak. Of Germany's top 200 companies, only one has a female CEO. Women hold under 8% of the seats in German corporate boardrooms. That's half the percentage held by women at Fortune 500 companies in the U.S. Barbara Klose-Hecht, president of Berlin's Business and Professional Women Club, says German business has a long way to go.
It's an old boys club, also in the leading positions of the enterprises. And the old boys, if they have to choose between women and men for these positions, then they vote for men.
One big reason for the single-sex boardrooms, experts say, is cultural. This German TV ad from the 1950s shows a smiling woman preparing food in her kitchen. Many in Germany are still locked in that mindset when it comes to gender roles, according to Elke Holst, an economics researcher in Berlin. She says many male executives still feel that promoting a woman who has children is risky because they may lack flexibility and commitment. In 2001, the German government sat down with business leaders and agreed on a voluntary program to help women move up the corporate hierarchy. It didn't work, she says.
The position in management of women does not get better. So I think if you don't want to wait forever, you have to take harder steps to reach your goal.
But to some, Deutsche Telekom's quota step was one step too far. German companies like Siemens and Lufthansa said they won't follow Telekom's lead. And Jana Schemke of the German Employers Association says decrees from on high are not the way to go.
We should focus instead on changing policies that push women into traditional roles. There are a lot of practical problems that stand in the way of women moving up in their careers.
Problems such as tax systems that favor single-earner households, usually with a male breadwinner. There's also a severe shortage of childcare facilities. Many schools let out at noon, making it hard for mothers to balance kids and career. The German government says it's not considering introducing mandatory quotas for female executives right now, but some of its neighbors are moving that way. Norway already has a strict quota law. France, the Netherlands, and Spain are in the process of drafting similar legislation. In Berlin, I'm Kyle James for Marketplace.
Success can be a somewhat subjective term. A lot of it depends on what your own personal measure of it is. But you can't argue against Warren Buffett's success, Bruce Springsteen's, Serena Williams. But what drives them might not be so much about talent as it is about that old chestnut about how you get to Carnegie Hall. Practice, practice, in the zone practice. Matthew Side is a sports commentator at the BBC in London, and his new book, Bounce, looks at what lies behind success in sport and other endeavors. It all started with his own achievement as England's number one table tennis champ.
It's quite a big sport in the UK, and yet when I looked around me, the other great table tennis players in the country happened to come from my street in a very anonymous suburb of a very normal town in southeast England. And I thought to myself, hang on a second, I knew enough about Darwinian evolution to understand that there hadn't been a genetic mutation that had only affected our street and none of the others.
You weren't surrounded by geniuses on
exactly.
Every block. Yeah.
It was to do with opportunity, in particular, the opportunity to practice with a brilliant coach in the only 24-hour-a-day club. So all of us, that cohort in that street, started out as ordinary table tennis players, but we ended up as extraordinary players.
You cite all kinds of endeavors and famous people who excelled at them. Mozart clocking 3,500 hours of practice by his sixth birthday. You talk about David Beckham kicking a soccer ball from the same spot for hours on end. So does genius come in here anywhere, or is science telling us that really that is irrelevant?
I suspect that no matter how long we probe into the DNA of these master performers, we won't find anything implicated in that sequencing. What we will find is extraordinary upbringings.
If excellence is all about practice and the number of hours you're putting in, is it possible to say how many hours it's going to take to become the best of the best, whether you're a musician or an athlete or even a CEO?
The earliest really paradigm experiment that took place in this field was by Herbert Simon and William Chase, two academics who looked at chess players, and they discovered that nobody had reached grandmaster quicker than 10 years. And Malcolm Gladwell, in his wonderful book Outliers, he says, look, 10,000 hours is the magic number in order to get to the top. However, it's not 10,000 hours of any kind of practice. If you don't approach it with a voracious appetite, if you don't clock up what Anders Ericsson, a very famous psychologist from Florida, calls deliberate practice, it's not going to get you anywhere.
I think one of the practical applications here is that you say the talent myth is disempowering, because it causes individuals to give up if they don't make early progress. And your answer to that is, again, look, don't worry about it. Just keep practicing.
Yeah. In fact, a brilliant psychologist, Carol Dweck from Stanford, has done some terrific research in this area. She took 400 fifth graders and gave them some simple puzzles. And afterwards, half of them were praised for intelligence, for talent. You must be really smart at this. The other half were praised for effort. Gosh, you must have worked really hard. Then she gave them some more difficult tasks to complete. Those who were praised for talent, for intelligence, when they came across these really difficult challenges and started struggling, they thought, oh my goodness, I don't want to lose that smart label. And it actually sapped their ability to persevere on the task. Those who were praised for effort, when they came across this really difficult problem, they thought, great, I can demonstrate now how hardworking I am. And they really ratcheted up their enthusiasm, kept going. So what Dweck argues very convincingly is that we must praise young people in any educational scenario for their effort and not for their talent, and try and embed what she calls the growth mindset.
So this is really a message to parents everywhere to stop calling your kid a genius and instead say, hey, good job for studying.
That's absolutely right. And Dweck argues that, you know, this particular experiment she's done in all different parts of the United States with different ethnic groups, and the result is always the same.
Matthew Side is the author of Bounce, Mozart, Federer, Picasso, Beckham, and the Science of Success. Thanks so much. It's been fun chatting.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. By Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, a story out of Arizona that has nothing to do with that new immigration law, though it does have similar overtones. Who among us didn't skip out on at least one lecture hall class in college, right? Well, according to the Arizona Republic, Northern Arizona University is using federal stimulus money to install an electronic system that will be able to read student ID badges as they enter and exit classrooms, all in the name of increasing attendance and, hence, academic performance, say school authorities. So much for leaving the parental nest. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 53 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ rose almost 1 point, a fraction of a percent. And the S&P 500 added 7 points, about 0.2%. Our engineers include Vahan Baladuni, Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewertz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, a renewed market for high-octane hooch.
What's the quote? Moonshine ain't for drinking, it's for selling. It was a business. It remains a business.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.